Hey, it's Larry from Iowa, and welcome to the Only Chip in the Cookie podcast. Today we've got a very special episode. We have our first female guest on the show today, Bethany Mayo. She is the education director for the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory in Baltimore, Maryland. She's going to talk to us about life as a Black actor in theater acting. As I scroll through Facebook, I'm feeling like there are probably some conversations that we need to have. So the first point that I would like to address, this black on black crime thing. I can't think of a single black person that thinks that the violence that is happening in some of our communities thinks that that is okay. But here's why I bring this up. A lot of y'all weren't really talking about quote-unquote black-on-black crime until we started to make some noise about a separate issue, which was the treatment and the brutalization of African-Americans at the hands of police. That is the main issue that we have been bringing to I shouldn't say that we've been bringing to the forefront, but that has been an issue that we have been rallying for and protesting for. When you guys hit us with the what about black on black crime stuff, first of all, to position it in that way is offensive. And here's why. You're making the assumption that there aren't people, that there aren't black people in these communities that aren't making noise, that aren't trying to do something to end or curtail the violence in these communities. There are lots of organizations, there are lots of individuals that are doing what they can to uplift these communities. Another thing that you probably don't understand is that a lot of these communities are deprived of a lot of resources that nicer neighborhoods or suburban communities have. And so when you have a community that is lacking of resources necessary to feed your family, to pay your bills, or to have access to mental health, or have access to healthy food, or have access to adequate health care, man, the culture of poverty is something else, and it can lead to people resolving issues in a way that you might not necessarily resolve them in. And so I'm not saying any of this to justify any of the horrendous murders that happen in black communities, but I am saying it's really not fair for you to make this assumption that nobody cares and that nobody is doing anything about it. What you have to understand is that when you turn on NBC or Fox News or CNN or any of these news networks and you see all of this footage about the protests and about Black Lives Matter and things like that, you have to understand that it's not typically black people in those control rooms that are publishing these stories. Because if you were to follow any black media at all, you will see that there are constant organizations where their founders have made it their life missions to end the violence, to provide resources that are going to lead to less destruction and less violence in these communities. You will see that there's lots of organizations that have been created to teach folks about financial literacy. You know, in fact, I'm on the board of a nonprofit that specifically aims to put books in the hands of poor black and brown kids in my community. Right? So I know firsthand that there's lots of us that are looking for the solutions and looking to end some of these problems that are happening in black communities. Okay, so if you are so perturbed by the things that are happening in black communities, I'm gonna need you to step your game up. I'm gonna need you to look up which local elected officials in these neighborhoods that you are so concerned about. I'm going to need you to do your research and figure out how politically or how with policy we can make change so that those communities have a remedy for some of those issues sooner. There are many ways for you to put your concern into action, but when we are talking about an issue, when we are talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, which by the way, Black Lives Matter as an organization and as a movement does not condone violence of any kind to any black person, regardless if it's by a cop or by another black person. So if you really knew about BLM, then you would stop saying things like Black Lives only matter when it's a cop on a black person. You know, Black Lives don't matter when it's black people on black people. We got to stop with that. And I've heard that from black folks and from white folks, and that's simply not true. It's a racist thing to say, and by perpetuating that belief, you are perpetuating racism. And here's why I call it racist. So we say black on black. I need y'all to Google where the phrase black on black crime comes from, because surprise, guys, there's a reason why you never hear the term Asian on Asian crime or Latino on Latino crime, or I'm sorry, Latinx on Latinx crime. Or white on white crime. Black people kill other black people at virtually the same rate that white people kill other white people, that Latinx kill other Latinx, that Asians kill Asians, and so on and so on. Okay, so let me repeat that. Blacks are killing blacks at the same ratio that whites are killing whites. And no one ever says we got to do something about this white on white crime. So when people are killing each other at the same ratio, essentially, what it means is that when you have an issue with someone in your neighborhood, you're probably going to take that issue out with someone in your neighborhood. Take all this black on black stuff out of your vocabulary. It does not make sense. It's offensive. It's insensitive. Another thing that I want to talk about is, I don't know if you would call this a microaggression or what, but I need y'all to hear me out on this. So when your black colleagues are conversing with you about black life or about these times in particular, this is not an opportunity for you to open up about your own struggles and to compare your struggle with the struggle that we are talking to you about. It's inappropriate, it's insensitive, and to act like your struggles and ours are an apples to apples comparison is inaccurate. Certainly, there are times where our history of oppression intersects one another, and when that happens, we can definitely relate there. Empathy is not hijacking a conversation so that you can feel better when you are confronted by your own inner biases. I'll give y'all the benefit of the doubt, okay? I feel like a lot of times what you're trying to do is relate, but when you just overpower and just overtake the conversation to compare your struggle to ours, it's not right. Replacing what someone is going through with your own plight is like replacing dishwasher detergent with Dawn dish soap. The intention was good, but now you have a big mess on your hands. Okay, empathy is the ability to understand and to share feelings with one another. And a lot of times, guess what? The best thing you can do for us is just to acknowledge us like you heard us. Like, literally, yeah, I hear you, is more than likely all that we were looking for in the first place. And trust me, we do this all the time. With every Garth Brooks concert recap that you share with us, or when you describe your ice fishing excursions, we might not have a single clue about what you're talking about. But if you like it, we love it, right? So we're vibing with you. We see that you are excited about what you're talking to us about. So we are excited about the fact that you had a good time. That's how empathy works. If something gets you down, we acknowledge that you're feeling low. That's how empathy works. Oh man, I'm sorry, that sucks. Now, I know what I'm saying might seem really detailed for the Dexter do-gooder that's listening, that's saying, well, you shouldn't be talking about race kind of stuff at work anyway, but the fact is, race is woven into every fabric of American life. And it just so happens to have a tremendous impact on your black coworkers or your black employees or the black managers that report to you, Mr. or Mrs. CEO. Listen, when you take care of black people at your job, you're taking care of your company. Stop dismissing us. Stop arguing with us. We are asking you to use your privilege to fight against racism and not create more of it. The division, the so-called division that people bring up when talking about the race thing, the division doesn't come from talking about it. The division comes from when people are so frustrated that they just walk away and end the conversation completely. And oftentimes it is the oppressed that has people walking away from her or him. So that might have been a little bit too deep for the intro, but that's life. This podcast was created to chronicle and to share with you guys some of the experiences and some of the feelings that we have as black folks who work with y'all. So just hear me out on this. And these topics that we talk about, they can all be researched, they can all be Googled. Okay. And I think I'm going to save my social media rant for next week. But here's a little preview. Don't be liking all of my kids' pictures on Facebook and crap, and then skip right over my Breonna Taylor posts or my Elijah McClain posts. Or my, we are demanding justice for black folks in this country post. When you do that, it sends a very, very telling signal. Honestly, what it says is, I like you, Larry, and your kids are cute, but fuck all that other stuff. I'm just being real. So. Anyway, hey, without further ado, we've got Bethany Mayo. She's awesome. You're gonna love her stories about her being an actress, and it's some good stuff. So, without further ado, here's Bethany. Okay, and we're back to the Only Chip in the Cookie podcast, and today we are joined by a very special guest, actress Bethany Mayo. Bethany, what's up?
Man, nothing. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Good.
I'm doing awesome. So, I want to make a couple points to everyone real quick. First of all, right now, Bethany, I don't know if you know this or not. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but we are making history with this episode. Do you know why?
No, tell me.
Because you are our first female guest on this show.
Woo woo. Hey.
Exactly. So, give it up for the ladies, give it up for the queens.
That is right. Tuesday
Yes.
is ladies' night.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And then also, you're also making history as being the first relative on the show as well. So, give it up for the cousins.
Yeah, I
Yay.
wondered if we were going to admit to being related or not,
No,
so.
it's all good. Absolutely. Absolutely. So Bethany is my cousin. She's my cousin. And I'll just say this, being the only chip in the cookie, lots of times I've grown up around lots of people where when you say, "Hey, so and so is my cousin," the first thing that they ask you is, "How?" Man.
How do you think, man?
Yeah, exactly. But
Our
like
parents are siblings. Like, what is
yeah.
this?
But I mean, like, I just mean, but I mean, even like, people I'd go to school with, or maybe coworkers, I'd be like, you know, we'd walk past somewhere and I'd say, oh yeah, so-and-so's my cousin. Why? How? And it's like, why do you need to know?
Sometimes I wonder if that's like a colonization holdover, right? Like a European thing. I don't know. They get a little deep, like right off the bat.
No, that's what this is about. This is about getting as deep as we can possibly go. So listen, as I mentioned earlier, Bethany is an actress. And when I say that, I mean that she performs on, do you say, how do you say it? Stage acting, theater acting? How do you?
I usually just go like you're a stage actor or you're a screen actor is most of the time what I hear.
Yeah.
In the differentiation between the two. The skill sets are completely different. So we just call it different stuff.
Gotcha.
You know, the acting stuff.
The acting stuff. Well, that's the thing. So, cause I'm glad that you helped me to define that because, you know, a lot of times you say, oh, so-and-so is an actress. The first thing that they want to know is what movie or what TV show. And it's like, is that the only acting that you're limited to or that you know about? Mm-hmm. But
And a lot of times when you say, oh, no, I do stage. I work on stage. I do live theater. They go, oh, well, you know where you should go. In New York, they have Broadway. And you're like, really? I never heard of that. Please tell me more. And it's like people think you can just drive up to New York and show up at a theater and get hired. And so they just, people always want to know, what have you been in? What have I seen you in? And then when they're disappointed that you haven't been in anything that they know about, then they want to know if you know about Broadway.
Word.
And you should just go there and you should work there. Cause that's obviously, you know, the only thing left.
Right. It's where all the actors go. Mm-hmm. so let's talk about your acting career, I guess. How long have you been acting? And, you know, is there a typical genre of play that you typically perform in, or tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I've been acting professionally, I want to say, since probably 2011 or 2012. By which I mean that was the first time that I got paid to do it, which I think is the definition of a professional, right? You put a check in my hand and now I'm a professional. But before that, I did high school theater and I did college. My major was musical theater, so I am trained for whatever that's worth.
Classically trained.
Well, actually, not.
Dang it.
The strange thing is that, well, I am now, but in the Midwest where we grew up, the thing that people love is musicals. They just love a musical. You can throw a rock at a theater doing a production of Oklahoma or Ragtime or, you know, whatever. We love musicals in the Midwest. But out here, I live in Maryland now. And on the coast, since Maryland is about a 5-hour drive. I live in the Baltimore, D.C. metro. So we're about 5 or 6 hours from New York. So being that close to New York, nobody wants to see your little ragtag musical because sort of the pinnacle of the American musical is 6 hours down the road. So what's really popular here is classical theater, namely Shakespeare. That has a lot to do with the fact that Shakespeare's so old, so you're not paying royalties or licensing fees. You can just, anybody anywhere can pick up a Shakespeare script, go to a playhouse or a field or some place where people could sit, of course, before COVID, and do a play that Shakespeare or anything that there's a period of time after which things are free to do. So I think that's a lot of the reason why theaters out here do a lot of Shakespeare is because budget-wise, it's very cheap to do.
Yeah.
So that is what I started doing when I moved out here in 2014 or 2015. I had only done one Shakespeare production, which was Romeo and Juliet. I did a production of that in Kansas City. And then I hadn't done another thing until I auditioned at a theater called Baltimore Shakespeare Factory, which is where I work now mainly. And we did a production called The Shoemaker's Holiday, which is written by a guy named, is it Thomas Dekker? He is a guy that was writing around the same time as Shakespeare, but because Shakespeare is kind of the end-all and be-all, a lot of the other contemporary writers that were writing around his time basically get the shaft. Like, nobody's doing that work. Mm-hmm. And so since that Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's mission is Shakespeare and his contemporaries, they make a concerted effort every year to do at least one production of a play of someone else who was writing plus or minus the lifetime of Shakespeare. So that's mainly what I do now, is classical work.
Wow. So I'm just thinking about the dialect and the way of speaking back in those Shakespearean times.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, you are a professional actress, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you prepare to speak entirely different than how you typically communicate? How does one go about that transformation? I'm so intrigued.
Oh gosh. So for a theater that has its poop in a group, as they say, has its sand together, they'll have something like a dialect coach. So someone who is, and you are, is such a thing as being certified in a particular dialect.
Yeah.
And having the ability to teach it. And so they hire someone whose job is to sit in rehearsal and listen to you talk. And they go so far as to talk about the shape of your mouth as you're forming the vowels, and they get really nitty gritty into the details of it until they deem you're passable, or until it's opening night and it's too late to do anything else about it.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that's some of my favorite stuff.
Yeah.
Or if you have a really good ear for an accent, sometimes you can kind of pick it up. Especially if it doesn't necessarily have to be good, if the accent is more comic as opposed to like factual historical, they'll kind of let you get by in something that's ridiculous. But most of the time in professionally minded theaters, you're going to sit with a dialect coach for maybe 6 to 10 hours of a 80-hour rehearsal process and work on the speech.
So do you feel any pressure to get those accents right? Or as an actor, as an actor, you just kind of know that you're eventually going to get it down.
Oh God. Yeah. You might eventually get it, but it might be after the show closes. So. I mean, I've been in shows where the accent was easy for me. The standard British is really easy for me. I have a French accent that's pretty easy. Some of the accents that have been more challenging, I find the German accent almost unproducible with my mouth. I don't know what it is. I can't do it.
Yeah.
And other people are like, it's all about the V's. I'm like, look, I can't do it.
Oh my gosh.
And then other things that are, it's funny that you should mention like what Shakespeare sounded like in his time, because there is a group of people.
A hardcore group
who have studied because within like Shakespeare nerds and acting nerds, and then even within that, these like dialect nerds who have studied using songs and poems and other literature from Shakespeare's time and have approximated what that English sounded like. And they call it original pronunciation, or OP. So Shakespeare, the Globe Theatre in London occasionally does productions in OP, and Baltimore Shakespeare Factory also occasionally does productions in OP once a year. So I think OP was probably the hardest accent I've ever had to tackle. It sounds a little bit Scottish, a little bit English. If you ever watch Downton Abbey, the accent that the servants use, it's called the Yorkshire dialect or the Yorkshire accent. That's probably the closest thing to anything that you could have heard that sounds like OP. But it's a little piratey. It's got a lot of R's in it.
Okay.
And I think that was the one that I struggled with most. And you can always tell when you're listening or watching a show who's really at ease with their accent or their dialect, and who's like, gosh, I know this is real terrible.
Yeah.
Or sometimes the people who it's terrible, but they don't know. Those are all kinds of actors that exist.
Man, let me tell you, I love accents. And now that I'm, you know, it's different times these days, and I'm not exactly getting paid for my accents, so I'm trying to keep my accents to myself nowadays, because I don't want to offend anybody, you know. I can offend it enough. I can offend it enough in these streets. But but no, thanks for answering those questions. I've just always been obsessed with how actors are able to just switch their dialects and completely transform to take on roles. So so now theater acting. Yeah, where we were growing up in the Midwest, Bethany, there weren't a lot of chips in this cookie.
No.
So how did you become interested in acting? How did you even know that this was a thing?
What happened was my mom and her sister always insisted, right, that I was a dramatic child, that I belonged on stage. And
I'm only laughing because I know that's totally not true.
Yeah. And so I remember one time that Oscar Mayer Wiener truck had come. I know we're that old. Had come, and they were wanting kids to come and sing the song, like as an audition, and to see who would be the next, like, Oscar Mayer Wiener kid or something. And my mom was like, you should do it. And I'm like, no, I'm shy. I'm not doing that. I'd be too embarrassed. And she didn't say anything. She let it slide. But sometime about high school, I had this group of friends, and one of them was into acting. And he said, look, I think you would have a good time. This was my sophomore year of high school. I played volleyball my freshman year, but I got hurt playing volleyball, so I couldn't do that. And my mom had insisted I have an extracurricular activity. So my friend was like, look, just come audition for this play. It'll be easy. We'll get to hang out a little bit, and like, you'll have a good time. So I auditioned for the school play. It was It's a Wonderful Life. And it was the most nerve-wracking, horrible, embarrassing thing that I had ever done.
Really?
I was so embarrassed. I was so nervous. My hands were shaking so bad I couldn't read the sides. So sides are what they give you for an audition. They won't give you the whole script because that's a lot to hold on to.
Yeah.
So they'll give you like a page or maybe two pages to read and do the scene, and then they can watch you and see how you're doing. I was shaking so bad that I almost couldn't read the paper. I was so nervous. And I left that audition. I was like, man, that was terrible. They are not going to cast me. This is awful. I'm never doing this again. And when the cast list went up, I was in the ensemble, which is what they do with when they need a bunch of people.
Yeah.
But they don't want to call you like random townsperson wandering through town. So they call you the ensemble, right? And that's okay. French, so you're feeling really fancy about it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm in the ensemble.
There you go.
And so I was cast in the ensemble, and we rehearsed for probably 5 or 6 weeks, and we did a Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night show. We struck the show. And striking the show is industry talk for taking the set down, putting the costumes away, putting the props away. Basically, everything you needed to do the show has to be put away.
Oh, struck the show.
Yeah, so you strike it.
Okay. Yeah.
And yeah, right? And so when you're in school, they make you strike everything. You know, we were taking screws out of flats, which are 2x4 things, platforms that have like a sheet of Luan on them, and that's what you paint the backdrop on, or sometimes you build like a platform for people to stand on, so you have different heights on the stage. You take all that apart. They let us use power tools. I mean, I'm surprised nobody left there missing a finger. And so you do all that, and then the show's over, and then you go and you go to Perkins or Denny's or whatever with all your stage makeup on because you feel proud like a weirdo. And you have dinner and you talk about the show. And that was my first experience. And by the time it was over, I just knew that I didn't want to do anything else with my life, but keep doing that.
That is beautiful. And I think the best part is that you found this joy at such a young age. I think that's huge. I think it's huge. I think it takes some people a very long time before they find out what their true passion is. So that's pretty dope, Bethany.
Yeah, I feel really lucky.
Yeah.
A lot of people, it takes them a way long time to figure out exactly what they want to do. But for me, it was that the whole thing, like the weirdo people, the crazy hours, the drama, the work, all of it. It just, I love it.
Right. So we're gonna switch gears a little bit, and look, this is the only chip in the cookie, right? And so okay, and if your job is anything like mine, and I don't really mean that like literally, I just mean, if you've worked in an environment where you were one of few blacks, if not the only black person, then you can relate to a certain set of challenges, right? And so I'm guessing that just based off of this profession and what I know, and there's a lot that I don't know about theater acting, but just, I'm going with a generalization here that perhaps there aren't a lot of black folks in your industry. If that's the case, if that's true, can you kind of take me to a point where you realized, something's a little off here?
Man, I wish I could. Okay, all right, here we go. So,
Uh-oh.
right? It starts early. And it's continuous. I was one of, I think probably the only black person doing theater in my high school program. I was absolutely the only black person doing theater in my college program, in fact. And if you contact anyone who was at school with me, they will tell you for sure. I had to make rules about when it was acceptable to make a black joke. I was like, you have between 9 a.m. and 10 p.m. to make all your black jokes for the day. If you don't get it in by 10 p.m., you just have to hold it and wait for the next day because I can't be dealing with it. Like where I was at school in central Missouri, and I chose to go to William Woods University, which is where I graduated from, because they had a musical theater program, and that's really the thing that gives me the most joy when I perform it. And so I wanted to study it and really get good. And so I went to a program where that was what I could major in. And it was a small private school in mid-Missouri. And I guarantee that I was, for some of those people, like the first black person they ever had extended contact with. I had a professor who asked me straight up why black people were afraid of water and why
My
black people
God.
didn't know how to swim. And she waited until, and we were alone. It wasn't like she asked me this in front of, the whole class. And she waited a couple of weeks to kind of, I guess, take my temperature to see if I was the kind of person who she thought, but she really was confused. She did not understand. And I said, well, a lot of black women, particularly, when their hair is straightened, that's a heat process. And so once you've got your hair all straightened and curled and stuff, the last thing you want to do is go jump in the pool because the moisture from the pool is going to ruin it. The same way it would, for your, if you had curls in. And she was like, oh, I see. I mean, I didn't want to get into all of it because there's like way more.
Exactly. That and that's man, I can relate to this on so many levels. One, I definitely know what it means to set those boundaries. You learned how to set those boundaries in college. I did not learn how to set those boundaries until I was a grown ass man. Because fortunately, most of the spaces that I operated, even though I was one of few blacks, I had always been around people that, for the most part, kind of thought like me in terms of equality and black folks and things like that, right? But it wasn't until I was in my 30s, my early 30s that I realized that the world wasn't kumbaya. And that messed me up. And then that's when I got sensitive to the black jokes. I always gave the benefit of the doubt in the past, but that's when I started to, set up the boundaries, 'cause yeah, I have no tolerance for that anymore. And then also too, I just wanted to say, I've had those experiences too, where someone will pull you to side and there won't be anybody else in the room, and they will ask you the most outlandish shit. And but you know what though? But something about it, it's like you can't even be mad. You can't even be mad because sometimes you, well, I guess you can be mad, but like sometimes, like for me, it's like, okay, I get it. I get it. You really don't understand, and you're trying to learn, and you understand that this could be a sensitive topic, so you at least gave me the courtesy of waiting until the room was clear. So, all right, I'll give you a little something. You could easily Google this, but I'll give you a little something. All right, cool.
I mean,
Man.
and it was just and the crazy thing about it is that in my profession, you have to really be careful because that same woman who asked me that, she was my voice teacher.
Damn, yep.
And she was the accompanist for our auditions. And so you really have to be careful about what tone you use and all of that stuff, because if I had been salty, which could theoretically well within my rights to be salty about some kind of question like that.
Yep.
And then I go into my next audition, and all of a sudden she can't figure out how to play my sheet
Yep. All of a sudden she hit C sharp when she should have hit F flat.
yeah, or something like it, or played it too slow, or played it too fast, or anything. And there's almost nothing worse in a musical audition, particularly, where you're like, I'm sorry, can I start over? They don't know. They say you can start over, but they've already made some decisions about you and your preparedness and further down sort of your professionalism by the time you are like, oh gosh, I need to start over. Like, that's something high school and college kids do. That's nothing that any sort of professional should really be asking for. So, when you answer these questions, even when people are acting some kind of how about it, I still feel the pressure to be diplomatic in my responses, just because, and not only whatever I experience, she and I one-on-one, but when she goes to talk to the director after rehearsal, what they two talk about and what she talks to anybody else, acting is a very, very word of mouth, particularly on stage. It's a very word of mouth situation. And so if you hear someone's difficult to work with, or someone's attitudinal, or someone's this, or someone's that, you hear that way before you ever see them in the audition room most of the time. And it really can be the difference between getting a role you really want and not, which is, oh, I heard so-and-so's difficult to work with. And then that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the situation that you're describing, you basically have no one to really advocate for you. You're in the middle of Missouri, there ain't no black folk. And yeah, like you said, you had every right to be like, man, why you asking me that kind of question?
Yeah.
But
I
to
mean, what's
be,
it got to do with you if it is or not? And if you're so
exactly.
worried about black people not being able to swim, why don't you find a club and donate to one? Donate some free lessons or something. Like, why are we talking about this? Yeah.
Exactly. And but I just feel like to be black in this country, and especially in certain parts of the country, it's like if you don't adjust to their fragility or their sensitivity, man, it could really cause a lot of strife on your life.
Yep.
And yeah, that's nuts. So tell me this. So when you, as you started to have certain experiences in theater, whether it was with professors or maybe with directors or castmates, how did some of these experiences affect you? And if you want to get into it, I mean, how would you process some of those emotions?
It's a very lonely feeling. I have been in shows where I was the only black person, wherever, anywhere, on stage, wholesale walk into the building, and I'm the only the only little chip in a very, very pale cookie. And so it's a challenge because you have to decide, is this something that I can frame in a way, if this is a difficulty or an issue or a problem, is there a way that I can frame this that I don't make it about race so that my concern can be addressed? Because a lot of some of these issues do kind of have some intersectionality. Some of them sit at the intersection of being black and being a woman. And so if I can slide the issue maybe away from a black stuff issue and make it like a girl stuff issue, then sometimes those issues can be managed a little bit better. But then do I even decide to bring it up? Is it worth the stress and whatever of trying to go through the proper channels to address it? When the likelihood is they'll say something like, "Oh, well, I didn't mean it like that," or "You know, you're valued here. That was an accident. This is a misunderstanding," or sort of any of the other language that is used to dismiss these kinds of concerns.
Absolutely. Absolutely. On our very first little warm-up episode where I'm just kind of opening up talking, that is exactly one of the scenarios that is discussed, is having to make so many choices in a split second when it comes to being truthful about a race-related topic.
Yeah, and when I listened to that episode, I was like nodding,
Oh,
like,
yeah. You heard it.
Yep, I've been in that situation, I've been in that room, I've been in that, and it's so instantaneous, right? And I wonder what my mind could be free to do if I wasn't having to, cycle through these instantaneous decisions. Is there anybody I can talk to about this? No. Okay, well, do I want to address it? I don't know. Then you kind of ruminate a little bit. What else could I be doing with that brain power?
Exactly.
I've
What?
got.
Yeah. Man, that is so true. It's like, do you realize? And I think, you know what? And yeah, and I think I even mentioned that in the episode, how I talk about how you get entangled in these conversations. I said entangled. Hold on. Shout out to Jada
Oh,
Pinkett.
I know. I heard all about that.
I didn't mean to say that, but you get wrapped up. You get wrapped up in these conversations that aren't even really conversations. And then you look up and you're like, dang, 25 minutes went by, 30 minutes went by. I've been debating with your ass about how it feels to be black, and you're not even black. Like, what in the hell just happened here? And then you're mad at yourself for even falling into that, but it just happens so dang quickly. And so I got the radar up at all time. Like, and now that I've had my days of reacting to off the wall questions or comments, now I'm kind of like Neo in the Matrix with it. I can see it coming a mile away. And I have the perfect sort of retorts back, just to kind of let people know, like, hey, do you really want to have this
Like, not
conversation?
today. You don't want to. You don't want none of this. Look, you better keep walking and find somebody else.
And I
I'm
and
not.
you know and and my thing is my thing is um Usually, not always, not always, but usually I'm okay with talking about this sort of thing and you know addressing questions or concerns or clearing stuff up. But if you come to me about it, the first thing I'm gonna do is, like we said earlier, establish some ground rules. So right around the time when all this George Floyd stuff, my bad, my phone was ringing. Right around the time when all this George Floyd stuff was going down, I started getting a lot of messages from white people.
Oh gosh. Okay. Yeah.
I got a lot. I got a lot of those. Hey, how you been, buddy? Just thinking about you. And some people were acknowledging, you know, their racist actions that they've had in the past and stuff like that. And I thought all that was dope. But I also got some people that reached out and they were like, you know, I would like to talk to you.
Oh geez, no,
Man, like
don't
you,
be talking to them.
well, what you want to talk? So, what you want to talk about? That's how I started responding. Like, what do you want to talk about? And if they dared to say, like, you know, I want to talk about the race stuff or whatever, blah blah blah, I would say, for us to talk about this is going to require you to listen to me. And in some cases, we might have to have you just listen to me. And then we talk another day about some of the other points that you want to make. And I literally map it out for people because I'm not gonna set myself up to be this like some dummy that you can just slap all these weird racial stereotypes on me and try to debate me with. Like, I know who I am, I know the facts, I've done my research. Now it's time for you to do the same. I look at all the stuff that the weirdos say, like the Hodge twins and Candace Owens, and you know, like I see that perspective too. Okay, so I'm versed in the BS that they say, but I bring that up to say, when you're black, you typically understand both sides, both points of view from the. You know, from the oppressed side to the oppressor side, right?
But we're
So,
obligated to understand both sides because
absolutely.
we have to work in a system. And in order to work within a system, you have to understand how it works.
Right,
Yeah,
right.
yeah.
You got it. You got it. So I'm like, yo, I'll talk, but y'all gotta listen first. And you know what? And I found that a lot of people have taken me up on that. You know, a lot of people have like, yeah, you know, and I've actually I've had a lot of conversations with folks lately where it's ended with, wow, I never looked at it like that. I never thought of it like
That's
that.
very
Wow.
encouraging to hear.
Man, it makes me feel great. Honestly, and these kinds of conversations do not happen online, for the record. These are
No.
face-to-face conversations. These are people that, for whatever reason, I've been able to, you know, give them that safe feeling, that approachable feeling or whatever, which, all right, cool. I get what that's all about, but I'm going to use my powers for good. So I'm going to use
Right.
my that approachableness to talk about and to tell the truth about the black issues and the stuff that's affecting our communities and our people and our children and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
but no, it's been great. It's been cool. Like, you know, just been able to help change some perspectives.
Yeah, that's amazing. I can't necessarily say that I've had that same experience, but I can also say that I really have time for people to, and some people have that deep-rooted patience to deal and talk and explain, and I'm to the point where I'm just like, look,
You either get it or
you
you don't.
agree or you don't agree. You either acknowledge that systemic racism is a problem and permeates our entire society, or you don't. And whichever one of those you are is really, really fine. Because I'm not gonna talk about this. So if you do, then we can talk. And if you don't, then we're done here. You know? And that's the place where I've had to come to for my sort of sanity. My spouse is not black, So I am the only chip in the cookie in my home also.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the way that my social media is structured, so actors on the whole do tend to skew liberal, at least socially. There
Yeah.
may be some weirdo fiscal Republicans, like with money, but like with social issues and abortion and gay rights, overwhelmingly actors are for all of those things.
Yeah.
And so I was seeing a lot of the fallout from the releasing of the George Floyd, though, a good 4 or 5 days before my spouse.
Yep.
And so I was all tense and like my shoulder blades were all tight, and I was just like so angry and sad and stressed out and all of this stuff. And so I started like asking people directly on social media, like, you can't, please don't. And I have a list of things that is, please don't anymore. Please don't post any snuff films
Yeah.
without a warning. Please do not post any typed out death word monologues for me to read.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Don't do that. Because to you, like, I think to the average person, and maybe this is a function of my acting brain, but like, those are words that someone literally just said, and then those were the last things they ever said ever. So
Yeah.
like, you're trying to, and a lot of it, a lot of my feed is white people. A lot of my friends and colleagues and coworkers and professionals are all white people. And so they're just posting this stuff left and right, like, 'cause it has such a visceral impact. Like, however you feel about it, you feel so strong and so fast whenever you see these images or hear this stuff or watch these videos. And so they're using it sort of as a hammer against other sort of tone deaf, culturally insensitive, completely unaware white people who are like blithely swimming through their feed. And I'm like, you are tormenting me. This is traumatizing. Because I work as the director of education for a regional theater, we have a Facebook presence. We have summer programming going on. I'm required to be on Facebook for work. And the last thing that I want to do is see all of this stuff. So, like, you have to post it and tell me that this is what I'm about to see so I can scroll. Like, if you need that visceral hammer to change people's minds and to work on people and to get people to see the injustice of it, I understand completely. What I don't need you to do it to me. So just let a girl know what it is, and I can scroll past, or there's a function on Facebook where you can make a post that, and the privacy settings are specific. And you can say, hey, show this post to everyone but Bethany Mayo. Great, cool, do that. Because I can't tolerate it. I just can't see it. I can't see it. I can't hear it. I can't read it. I've turned the news off in the middle of the broadcast. I've turned the radio off in the middle of it. I just can't. I just can't deal with it.
It's so hard, and I can relate. Me personally, I'm on the side of I cannot watch any of those. I have to this day, I have not seen the full George Floyd video. I
Yeah,
don't
me
think I've
neither.
even seen any like clips. When it first happened, I just read the headline, and at the time that was all I needed to know. And it was our this the headline was already triggering. One of my homeboys sent me an article, was like, well, just read the article. And I read that, and I was like, man, why did I open this?
Yeah.
It's just so much trauma. And when you read one story in your mind, you can't help but to think about the many others that have come across your eyes over the years. I am on the side that I feel like we're at a point where desperate times call for desperate measures. I don't know if it was Shakespeare that said that, but
I mean, he said a lot of stuff, but I can't remember for sure. I'm a terrible Shakespeare person because I haven't read them all.
Well, right, right, but I do see the value, I guess, in knowing that it was, it does, you know, unfortunately, I hate that it takes someone having to die, but it's like, man, people weren't saying anything about anything until they saw this video. And now there is some stuff that's happening. And when you see these protests, you know, you're not just seeing black folks protesting. I'm seeing like at least 50-50, you know, white and whoever else protesting in all these nationwide protests.
I feel like
with this video and with more information and stuff like that, it's creating an undeniable calling for a lot of these folks to stand up for what's right. So
yeah.
We'll see. So I want to ask you a few more questions about,
yeah, sure, go for it,
life as an actress. So I'm hoping that at some point in your career you've come across some black folks, some black actors. Is there like a network that y'all kind of, an unofficial network that y'all kind of belong to, or you know, when you see another black actor, do you do the head nod, or
Oh gosh, when another black actor, it's like, hey, what are you doing here?
Yep,
shit, they hired both of us. I was part of a production last Christmas, and I walked into that rehearsal room and half the cast was black.
Oh, wow.
Legit 50%. And I can tell you that since I moved here, I have never had that kind of diversity and representation in a in a show that I've been in that wasn't expressly at an organization that really focuses on black actors. This was a theater whose focus is Shakespeare and the classics. Yeah, and I was like, shit, you're here? Shit, you're here. Mm-hmm. Oh, fuck, we're all here. What is this? Like, is this something about to go down? Are we in trouble? Should we not get in the car if they say let's go for a drive? Like, what is happening here? And that was a really pleasant experience.
Yes.
It's a little weird, because it depends on what level of professionalism you're operating at. So there's kind of like a cake with like four or five layers.
Mm.
So at your very bottom, you have community, like local community theater. And those people are like the diehards. I love it. They go to their lawyer job and do their 40-hour work week or their 80-hour work week or whatever it is. And at night, after they get off the clock, they come to the theater and they do shows for free.
Huh.
That is, and that's kind of the bottom. And so then the next level up, you sort of have these transitional community. So they're small, they're local. When I say community, in this situation, I mean that they're local-ish. But they are professionally minded. This is the kind of organization that will pay you a little bit, what they call a stipend. So a stipend is like, thank you for your time. Mm-hmm. If we could pay you more, we could, but we can't. So like, here's $200. And so that's kind of the next sort of range. I also like to call it like sketchy pro, because you are getting paid. But most of the time, these places are not part of the Actors Equity, which is the Actors Union. And so you can't rely on the predictions of Actors Equity in those places necessarily. So, you know, and then the next level up is like regional Actors Equity union houses. So in Baltimore, that's places like Center Stage. I'm trying to think, maybe Everyman is kind of in that area. And in Des Moines, that area of the cake is kind of missing. Maybe the closest thing you might have, because there's a lot of like local community theater in Des Moines. and Iowa, where I've worked, and also in Kansas City, where I've worked. But a lot of times in the Midwest, what you have is community stuff, and then you have these big houses where stuff comes through on tour. And they're not hiring local actors. Those people are coming from New York or LA or wherever they get touring actors from, they're coming by. So those are kind of the four levels: the community theater, the sketchy pro, the regional union, and then these big massive national tours. And so depending on where you fall in that cake, you're only associating with those same actors that you're seeing either out on auditions or in the room. And then So I know the people that I'm likely to see in an audition room or waiting to audition. I know people when I see them, black people specifically, I'm like, oh, you're here. That's a problem for me. Because if you're here and I'm here, now we're the same type. And so, you know, that creates a little bit of competition. So there is some, you know, the nod, the proper nod, like, hey, how you doing? Like, I see you.
Yeah.
My sister.
Yeah.
But there also is a little bit of fear. Because if I show up and you show up, and we're both black here, and most of the theaters, and I don't know that they necessarily do this on purpose. Again, this is might possibly be a function of systemic racism and internalized white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
But you will only see, usually, one actor of any given minority, like, of a gender. So you might see one black guy and one black girl on stage together, or one, you know, Asian person and, you know, Asian guy and one Asian girl. But you rarely experience a situation where they're hiring multiple black people, they're hiring multiple non-white people, or I think we're going with BIPOC. Most of the time, the casts, you're talking 70, 80, 90% white people. And like one little person. So there's a duality to seeing other black people working. Is like you're proud for them, you're happy for them, but there's a little bit of fear that both of you being in the market is meaning less work for you.
Right. Right.
So yeah. Dang. That's complicated.
Man. Where's Tyler Perry when we need him?
I am saying. You know,
No, go ahead.
No, I've just, you have to go out. I think he hires out of Atlanta.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
We're not doing any national tours these days anyway. No, I don't know when was the last time he did a Madea play.
No, Because plays are hard work. I don't know.
Because with the film, you show up, you shoot it. It maybe takes, you know,
take some breaks,
4, 5, 6 months, and then it's over. When you tour a show, you're doing that show, that 2.5 hour, 3 hour show every night, sometimes twice a day. And then you get in a car or a bus or a van or a plane and you go to another city and then you do it again and then again and again and again. So like touring, national tours for stage productions, like I respect that hustle. I thought I wanted to do that. And I probably would have, and then I got married, and I didn't want to be separated from my husband for that period of time.
Yeah, that would be tough.
But it's a hustle. It's a hustle, and it's hard work.
Yeah, and to think, like, man, for him to do someone like Madea, like, every night for, what, two, three hours, whatever?
He's got to be hot.
Man.
Because they don't make fat suits out of any kind of breathing material.
Right.
That's all polyester, all foam. So it's hot. And then the lights are hot. And, you know, sometimes we as people, when we be seeing other people, we don't act right. So you have no idea, you know, what your audience is going to be like, how lit they're going to be, you know, what's going on. That can be really fun when you have a really active and engaging audience. And you go out there and you come back and everybody who hasn't gone out yet is like, how is it? How are they? Are they laughing?
Yeah.
And sometimes you're like, these people are drunk and they are having the best time. They will laugh at everything.
Yes.
And then sometimes you come back and it's like, they need to drink some more.
Oh, my gosh.
They're a little uptight.
You know what? So I went to... there is a play that was playing here in Des Moines. It was called Hooded, and
Okay.
it was a Pyramid Theater production.
I've heard of Pyramid Theater.
Yeah, and so this play, gosh, let me think. It was about race. I don't remember all of the details, but I saw this play when it came out. I think it was like 2017. Yeah, I think it was 2017, so a few years ago. And there's a scene where this white character picks up a manual, and this manual teaches him everything that he needs to know about how to be black, right? And so
Okay.
the play had a lot of the play had a lot of humorous moments, but it also had a lot of moments that made you think, because that's just how the play was designed. Well, at this time of my life, I'm like ultra woke, right? So there's so much symbolism throughout this whole play, and I'm picking up on every single innuendo, like every single thing, like, oh, but there's some truth in that joke. And I'm just like, really, like, I'm just sitting there, like, I must have been sitting there stone faced. And at the intermission, this guy taps me on my shoulder, and he's one of the like ushers, or like one of the, you could tell that he's with the theater company. He's not an actor or anything. And he says to me, he goes, "Hey, brother, it's okay to laugh during some of these parts, man." I was just feeling it, man. That's man, I was going through some stuff back in 2016, 2017. That was 2016 was when Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, when they died back to back like that,
Yeah, that was hard.
that
That was
changed my
hard.
life. Yeah, that changed my life for real. All right, so just a couple quick questions, and then we'll
Whatever,
wrap
whatever you
up.
need.
Well, I mean,
I mean, I'm sure you have stuff to do with the coronavirus
Oh man.
on the rage, Madame Rona,
Madame Rona.
as the kids say. I guess the kids are saying that. I don't know what the kids say anymore because I always know what the kids say when I go into the classroom in the springtime, and then I teach these Shakespeare classes. So then I like get all up on the slang and what the kids are saying, but obviously I didn't go to school this past spring, so I have no idea what the kids are saying. So if you could tell me, somebody who's got the kids, just send
Yo,
me a quick email what the kids are saying.
I think they're calling it, I think they're calling it the Rona. I think they're calling it the
The
Rona.
Rona.
Yeah, the Rona. That's what I've been calling her. I've been calling her the Rona.
The
The
Rona,
Rona.
I dig it. I dig it. So, out here we have these phases, because Governor Hogan has really been really clear with his leadership from the governor's office all the way down. And theaters are closed until we get to stage three. And stage three will only be triggered if there is a medical therapy and or vaccine. So what you're looking at, like Broadway just announced that they're basically closed through the remainder of this year and almost all of next year.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of theaters are doing the same thing. So the remainder of where I work as director of education, our season has been canceled. Several of the other theaters that I've worked at around town have made the decision to cancel the rest of their seasons through basically through December. So there are a lot of actors here who are out of work. And those actors who are part of the union have some recourse, especially if they were under contract. They get paid through what the end of their contract was supposed to be. But for those of us who are non-union, we're considered 1099 independent contractors. So that's just money out the window that can never be returned. And in a lot of the earliest packages, there was no accountment for gig workers and independent contractors. So a lot of people I know are really struggling because what they do for their living and how they make the majority of their money. has been completely just squashed.
Well, I'll tell you what, cousin, when you're ready to give 30-minute acting lessons online behind a paywall, you hit me up
All
and
right.
I will help you make this a reality and not trying to make light of this COVID pandemic.
Oh man, you gotta make light of it or
But
cry all
you
day,
know, not
so
trying to,
you gotta.
not trying to make light of it, not trying to make light of it, but if you know, if you want to kick around some ideas on how to make some coin, I think we can make this happen.
I love it.
We need to come out with the Bethany Mayo Online School of Acting
Awesome.
classes in
Yeah,
session.
who would take it? Oh my goodness.
So my last question
Sure.
is, so acting, right? It's changed your life. It's had such a profound impact on you. What does acting mean for you in your life, and why do you love it so?
So it has to do with that feeling that you were talking about, right? That show that you saw, that it made you think, it made you laugh, it made you introspective. And that's the power of live theater. And I'm not going to say you can't get that from movies because you can. I've certainly had movies that made me think that I saw once and I still think about all the time. Crash being one of those movies. I still think about aspects of that movie. Now, maybe a little more than a few years ago. But there's something about being in the room with people. You're breathing the same air. You're feeling their energy. And like the difference between an engaged audience and a disengaged audience from the actor's standpoint is palpable. Like it is a thing you can feel when you have the audience with you, when they're on the ride, when they're completely invested in the story. Versus when they're not, like it, you just know, you can just feel it. And so that educational, cathartic aspect of storytelling and being vulnerable and allowing other people to access their vulnerabilities in a way that's comfortable and temporary so they can process it, but that will stay with them and cause them to think and hopefully change their life. That's the thing about acting that draws me. So there are some people like me who like that educational, cathartic, emotional experience. And that's where they root their practice and their technique and how they operate on stage and how they engage with their castmates and the audience. And then there are some people who just love it. You know, they're exhibitionists, they love the attention, they love the costumes, they love doing it, you know, and I'm not going to say that those actors are cool because they're not. It's just a different philosophy. So that for me is why I'm drawn to it. And I think it's because I am truly an educator at heart. When I was in high school, about halfway through, one of my English teachers, Katie Miller, shout out, hey, Miss Miller, she told me that she said if you're not a teacher by the time you're my age, she said, I'll buy you a steak dinner at 8 to 1 grand. And I was like, please, I'll be seeing you for that dinner because I hate kids. I think they're super annoying. I'm not gonna be a teacher now. I'll see you, you know. And a couple of years ago, when I first got into teaching, I was teaching theater-based educational programming. I had to email her with my metaphorical hat in my hand. I was like, look, I know I said you were crazy, but I love it. And that it's all the same. It's all in the same pool, that teaching, that educating, that focus on empathy and vulnerability and what we can all learn from each other. That's what theater is, to me. And that's what keeps me doing it, even though sometimes it's hard and sometimes it's uncomfortable. Sometimes people ask me, like when I'm in a rehearsal process, if I'm having fun. And sometimes I'm like, no. I'm not having fun.
Right.
You know, the week before our show opens, you're an 8-hour rehearsals a day.
Yeah.
I worked at a theater company where we rehearsed 10 out of 12 hours straight the Saturday and Sunday before the theater opened. And then we showed up at 6 o'clock and then we did the show until it was done, and then they gave notes, which are critiques on your performance and some other things.
Hmm.
And that would frequently go until 11:30 or midnight.
Yeah.
And then once you're finished with all that, you have to go back to the dressing room, take off your costume, hang it up, take your makeup off, and drive home. And for me, that's a 30-minute commute. So you're talking about the week before a show opens, I'm spending a lot of time at the theater and getting very, very little sleep, and then at all. but mm-hmm. when you open and it's well-received and people like it and they get it, you know, I imagine it's something like childbirth. I don't have any children yet. but like it's really awful while you're doing it. But after it's over, you're like, that was such a beautiful experience and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I have a child, I'll let you know if it's actually the same.
I'll tell you what. So my hippie wife, that's how she would describe it, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah. Oh man. Yeah, five kids, man. You've seen some things.
I know, you got a basketball team.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, well, yes. So okay, so I lied. I do have one more question for you. This is my last question. Technically it's my second to last question. But so real quick, if you had to give a message to a director or to a theater professor or to a drama teacher that had that one chip in the cookie in their class or as a part of their cast, other than don't refer to them as chip in the cookie, what advice would you have for that director or those teachers?
I would say you need to treat that actor or that student the same while also acknowledging that fundamentally they are not the same. So your Black student, castmate, whatever, you know, whatever we want to call it, is operating at a disadvantage. So in your dealings with them and in the way that you treat them in the rehearsal room or in the classroom, you need to make it abundantly clear to the other people in the rehearsal room or in the classroom that there is equality here and or equity or whatever buzzword it is we're using right now to just truly demonstrate the fact that this person is a theater professional and or a learning student, right? And we're all learning here. We're all in this together, which I hate super saying that, but yes, that we're all here together and we're all here as collaborators and that everybody's opinion is necessary in the foreground. In the background, you need to be doing everything it is that you can to level the playing field, to be telling stories. And please be careful about what you pick for your students or your actors to do. Be mindful of the time and be ready to defend yourself against an audience member. Side anecdote, I was in a production in college and it took place in France at the turn of the century, the turn of the 1800th century. Mm-hmm. And my character was married to the other character who was the owner of a bar. And one of the patrons, after they saw the show, they were like, the show is good, but like, what was a Black person doing married to a white guy? And I don't actually know how the director responded, but how I would respond if I was the director, I would say, if there was any place that a Black woman and a white man could be married, it is turn of 18th century France, because France abolished slavery a long time before the United States. In fact, in France, slaves could sue for their freedom if they were brought to France by their by their slave master. Enslaved people could sue for freedom and get it.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Wow.
So if there's any place that would be happening, France is the place. Read your history book and shut the fuck up.
Wow. I wonder, that is so crazy. I wonder if that influenced James Baldwin's reasoning for moving to France.
France is kind of a place, because if you think about the Harlem Renaissance, and I'm going to try not to go too far off into theater history with you.
No, please
if
do.
If you think about the Harlem Renaissance with all of these black artists, the jazz artists, the singers, the dancers, where did they all end up? Europe, particularly France. Black ballerinas, Josephine Baker made herself quite at home in France for a long time. And the reason is, even though I am not going to say it was all like roses and sunshine, like there was still bigotry there and there was still otherism and fetishism and all of that stuff. But, you know, Josephine Baker made fetishism her bitch, right? Hmm. She used to dance around in a banana bikini. That's her trademark, with leopards on stage. And all those French, European, white people would come and pay their money and come and see her dance. And she lived there for years, like 20, 30 years, quite happily.
Man, and I didn't know any of this stuff.
We're talking about like the 20s and 30s when she never could have done anything like that in the United States.
No.
So there was a lot of black artists that exported themselves to Europe, to France, ballerinas, singers, dancers, all that stuff. Because there was just that much less to fight with and deal with than it would be to try to perform in the United States.
Huh.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That much less bullshizzle.
Yes, bullshiggity, as I would say if I was talking to my parents.
Right. Oh, man. Man, this has been really wonderful, Bethany. So awesome catching up with a professional and with a family member. Mm-hmm. So if someone wanted to get to know you a little bit, as far as like, you know, checking out your actor CV, or to see what kind of projects that you're involved in right now or have been involved in, is there a place where someone can go to look up more information about you, social media or anything like that?
Yes, you can find me on Facebook. I do have an actor page. Just search Bethany Mayo, and it will come right up.
Is it Bethany Mayo?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I had to separate myself. I had to change my name, my personal Facebook name, because I started teaching, right? And this is another age thing, right? But when Facebook came out, I was in college. And the only other people on Facebook were also in college. So when I tell you there are some photos of me doing some college shiggity that it's not bad or anything. It's nothing that I would be embarrassed for someone my own age to see. However, when I'm trying to maintain authority in the classroom, I cannot have you seeing the photo of me drunk climbing out of the dryer in my apartment. So we can't be friends until you have graduated beyond my authority. I mainly teach between middle school and high schoolers. So once you go to college, we can be friends.
Yes.
But until then, so when you search Bethany Mayo, the only thing that you find is my professional actor page on Facebook.
Gotcha.
And then you'll know it's me because I'm black and my natural hair is out. I think I changed it back to my normal headshot.
I'm on it right now. Black and beautiful as ever.
Oh, thank you. So kind. All right. That's how you can find me.
Cool.
You can also find me at BaltimoreShakespeareFactory.org. I am their director of education, so feel free to email me at bethany@baltimoreshakespearefactory.org. Hello,
awesome.
World.
Oh, my gosh. Well, this has been a true treat, a true pleasure, and I'm so thankful that we're going to have an opportunity to share your story with our audience. So thank you so much, and as always, folks, this is the place where you can come and talk to and listen to what it's like being the only chip in the cookie, right? What it's like being one of few or the only black person at work or school or wherever. And so if you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast. And we look forward to connecting with you next time. All right. Peace out.
Hey, this is Larry from Iowa, host of the Only Chip in the Cookie podcast. And hey, if you enjoyed what you heard, please consider donating. We want to take the podcast to another level. Would love to invest in some better microphones and some mixing equipment and computers and stuff like that. So please consider donating to the Cash App link below. And we look forward to delivering even better content to you guys. Thanks.